Endurance. A year in space. A lifetime of discovery. Author, Scott Kelly. Arriving at the ISS. The rocket engines roar to full capacity. We sit rumbling on the launch pad for a few seconds. Then, our seats push hard into our backs. Some astronauts use the term kick in the pants to describe this moment. The slam of acceleration, going from still to the speed of sound in a minute, is heart-pounding and addictive. Suddenly, we are thrown forward against our straps, then slammed back into our seats. The last engine cuts off with a bang, and there is a jolt, like a minor car crash. Then nothing. The spacecraft is now in orbit around Earth. We are in weightlessness. We smile at one another and reach up for a three-handed high five, happy to have survived this far. We won't feel the weight of gravity again for a long time. Like me, my Russian crewmates Gennady and Misha served in their military before being chosen to fly in space. Though it's something we never talk about, we all know we could have been ordered to kill one another. Now, we are taking part in the largest peaceful international collaboration in history, the International Space Station, ISS. When people ask whether the space station is worth the expense, this is something I always point out. What is it worth to see two former enemies transform their weapons into transport for exploration and pursuit of scientific knowledge? Misha's and my mission to spend a year on ISS is unprecedented. A normal mission to the space station lasts 5 to 6 months. So scientists have a good deal of data about what happens to the human body in space for that length of time. But little is known about what happens after month 6, and there's only one way to find out. Life in space. I've been on station for a week now. I'm often still disoriented about how my body is positioned. I'll wake up convinced that I'm upside down, and when I turn on light, I have a sort of visuals illusion that the room is rotating rapidly as it reorients itself around me. My brain is just readjusting. I look at my tasks for today. Mission control schedules our days using a program called Onboard Short-Term Plan Viewer, which rules our lives. Our task for the day is to capture Dragon, a visiting spacecraft carrying food and supplies to us. It's in orbit 10 kilometers away, and when it reaches the capture point at 10 meters away, we will capture it with one of the station's robot arms and attach it to the berthing port on station. Even after the two spacecrafts have mated, the danger Dragon poses to the station is not over. We have to check the integrity of the seal between the station and the Dragon by introducing air between them. If the air pressure inside were to decrease, that would indicate that the seal has been compromised and that opening the hatch between the two spacecrafts would mean venting the breathable air out into the cosmos. This is glacially slow and deliberate process. Fluid shifts. Maybe the most troubling negative effect of long-duration mission in space is the damage to astronauts' vision. The hypothesis is that increased pressure in the cerebral fluid surrounding our brains is causing the vision changes. In space, we don't have gravity to pull blood, cerebral fluid, or any other fluid to the lower half of our bodies, so the cerebral fluid tends to increase pressure in our heads. It feels like standing on your head 24 hours a day. Mild pressure in your ears, congestion, round face, and flushed skin. Misha and I will be spending a lot of time this week working on an experiment called fluid shifts, which will examine this theory. We'll take turns wearing pants that reduce the pressure of the lower half of our bodies, reducing the amount of fluid in our heads. They took a lot like the bottom half of the robot from Lost in Space. On the ISS, science takes up about a third of my time, from growing plants to experimenting on rodents and on myself. The data collected from this experiment is still being analyzed as I write this, and the scientists are excited about what they are seeing so far. Results in scientific papers will continue to emerge over the years and decades based on the 400 experiments we conducted over the year. Late notice conjunction. This is a red late notice conjunction, Mission Control on Earth tells us, with the closest point of approach within a sphere of uncertainty. A conjunction is a collision. A piece of space junk is headed our way. Late notice either means we didn't see it coming or we miscalculated its trajectory. And red means it's going to get dangerously close. We'll all likely die. Mission Control directs me to close and check all the hatches on the U.S. segment of the station. With the hatches closed, if one module is hit, the other might survive, or at least their contents won't be sucked out into the vacuum of space. I get to the Russian segment where I see the cosmonauts have not bothered with closing their hatches. They think closing them is a waste of time, and they have a point. The two most likely scenarios are that the satellite will miss us, in which case closing the hatches will have been pointless, or it will hit us. In which case, the whole station will be vaporized in an instant. The Russians' approach is to spend their last 20 minutes having lunch. 10 minutes before the potential impact, we make it to the Soyuz, the spacecraft we could use as a possible lifeboat. We slide into our seats in the dark, cramped, and loud Soyuz. The clock counts down. Once the time gets down to seconds, I feel myself tensing, starting to grimace. We wait. Then nothing. We look at one another with the last heartbeat of anticipation of disaster. Then, our grimaces slowly turn into expressions of relief. The moment has passed. Mission Control says, "It's safe. You can go back to work now." Later, as I reflected on the situation, I realized that if the satellite had hit us, we probably wouldn't even have known it. We would have gone from grumbling to one another in our cold Soyuz to being blasted into a million directions as diffused atoms, all in the space of a millisecond. Our neurological systems would not even have time to process the incoming data into conscious thought. I don't know whether this comforts me or disturbs me. Spacewalk. Spacewalkers aren't only necessary for explorations, but also for performing maintenance, repairs, or assembly on the exterior of the spacecraft, which we will be doing today. I'm floating in the U.S. airlock, wearing a 250-pound space suit, while the air is slowly pumped out. I've been in the suit for hours now. I can't see Kajal's face because we're crammed into a space the size of a compact car at odd angles, his head down near my feet. Once the airlock is nearly at vacuum, Kajal and I do a series of checks on our spacesuits to make sure they are not leaking. This process consists of a series of switch throws and slides of a level, all of which are extremely difficult to do while wearing the suit's gloves, sort of like trying to change a car's tires while wearing a baseball glove. It takes the ground about 10 minutes to tell Kajal and me to go outside. We move ourselves hand over hand along a path of rails attached to the outside of the station. On Earth, walking is done by feet. In space, it's done by hands. I'm immediately struck by how damaged the outside of the station is. Micrometeoroids and orbital debris have been striking it for 15 years, creating small pits and scrapes as well as holes that completely penetrate the handrails, creating jagged edges. It's a little alarming, especially when I'm out here with nothing but a few layers of spacesuit between me and the next strike. Being outside is clearly an unnatural act. When the sun is out, I can feel its intense heat. When it sets, 45 minutes later, I can feel the depth of the cold, from plus to minus 270 degrees Fahrenheit in minutes. If I were to take a moment to ponder what I'm doing, I might completely freak out. Return to Earth. If the process of getting up to space is violent and uncomfortable, the process of coming back down is even more so. Descending in the capsule is one of the most dangerous moments of this year, and it will be one of the most physically grueling. Earth's atmosphere is naturally resistant to objects entering from space. The atmosphere is designed to kill us. We are in the seat liners that were custom molded to fit our bodies. We will go from 17,500 miles per hour to a hard zero in less than 30 minutes. And the seats, along with many other parts of the capsule, must work as designed to keep us on the winning side of a battle against the forces of nature. When we get the word from the ground that it's time to do orbit burn, we're instantly completely alert. It's important to get this part right. We execute the burn perfectly. A 4.5-minute firing of the braking engine, which will slow the capsule by 300 miles per hour. We are now in a 25-minute free fall before we slam into Earth's atmosphere. We feel gravity begin to return, first slowly, then with a vengeance. Soon everything is oddly heavy, too heavy. My watch feels heavy on my wrist, and breathing gets harder as the gravity forces clamps down on my trachea. We hear the wind noise building as the thick air of the atmosphere rushes past the capsule. It won't be long, maybe only a second or two, before we feel the jerk of the parachute. Everything now depends on it. We're all falling at the speed of sound. We fall and wait and watch. Life on Earth. I've been asked often what we learned from our year in space. Personally, I've learned that most problems aren't rocket science, but when they are rocket science, you should ask a rocket scientist. In other words, I don't know everything. I've learned that an achievement that seems to have been accomplished by one person probably has hundreds, maybe even thousands of people's minds and work behind it. And I've learned that it's a privilege to be the embodiment of that work.